Welcome to Mill City Hall. It's a Minneapolis politics podcast, and this episode is part two of us telling the story of Mayor Jacob Frey. So going back to the last episode, if you want to review the early years. I am Jesse Mortensen. My co-hosts are former council member and council staff Cam Gordon and Robin Garwood. We left off with Robin bringing us up to the brutal murder of George Floyd by police officer Derek Chauvin. Let's get back into it.
And then the whole thing exploded when Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd. And that was definitely a sign, I think, to everyone in not just Minneapolis, but the entire world, that the way we do policing is like rotten at its core. I mean, not only was Derek Chauvin empowered to be on the street lethally armed, doing the kinds of things that he did. He was a training officer. He was training other people how to be a cop. And he was saying, this is how you do it. You kill a guy. And the rest of them did not have, the training or the permission within the power structure to say, we need to stop this. Even though I think, you know, that video makes pretty clear that those other officers were pretty well aware that what was going on was not good, but they couldn't say, you need to stop doing that now. And it showed that the let's just trust Rondo approach, let's shovel money at the police department and trust Rondo, had not worked. And that was seen not just here, but all over the country and all over the world.
We were in the news for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. So a giant chunk of what Jacob had run on had been shown to be, his approach had been shown to be hollow, unsuccessful, not even really a thing that he quite did any, you know, he hadn't instituted the kinds of changes that would have stopped another police murder. It was now shown really viscerally that he hadn't done that.
There had been others too.
There had been others. But then in the immediate aftermath of that, and this is sort of, you made the point earlier, Cam, about a time that Rondo pulled folks back. And I was there at the moment that Rondo didn't pull folks back from around the third precinct. I was there when that protest went from being something where there were a very large number of people there who were very, very angry and had every right to be, with a small number of people climbing a fence into a place where there were parked, I think, civilian vehicles. I think it's the police officer's own cars. They like picked up a plastic trash can and started throwing it around in there. And that's when the SWAT team came out heavy and started tear gassing the crowd. And that's when we lost control of what had been brewing. And Rondo, as far as I'm concerned, ignited a bomb that burned my neighborhood to the ground, like a big chunk of it.
I don't even know where Rondo was or the mayor. They were basically no word from them, nothing that evening. I don't know. So whether it was his decision to do that, or so this is one theory I have, is somebody made the decision in the precinct and they said, we don't have to listen or ask anybody else. Let's go to the roof and start shooting people. Oh,
you know. They came in hard though with like SWAT trucks that had been staged somewhere else that came down that alley right behind Moon Palace Books and started popping rounds off at folks from all kinds of different angles, like to kettle people away from the building somehow.
So you think Rondo probably knew and was
somebody gave an order for a big
operation. Yeah, it was organized. I mean, I was there too, right? I was there for the whole first day of protest that started the day after George Floyd was killed, and definitely like felt the mood. The mood was dire. People were just like set in with rage, not like it didn't feel like an explosive, like, hey, we're just rolling in to break things. But it felt like this deep in your bones rage and resentment. And it, that moment sticks out to me as well as a big turning point, that first day things start to go a little bit ragged. And what the police do is clearly, I mean, it was very organized. It was like, okay, if things, you know, kick off in a beyond some point for us, here's what we're going to do. And absolutely, like, my experience on the ground was once they came in and tear gassed the whole area, then it was like, okay, this is a huge fuck you, right? Like, to everybody who was, as you say, deeply legitimately angry, it was a huge fuck you. Like, this is your first day of reaction to protest to this, and we're going to come in force, and we're going to try and squash the whole, everything that's happening here. Like, we're going to, there's nothing selective about what happened, right? It was, we are going to tear gas the entire intersection. And from that point forward,
it was war.
That it was war. It was Fortress Police, right? It was Fortress Precinct Building, and it was days of the cops continued down that pattern from that point of like, you're not taking our building. We're going to sit up here and shoot at you, and there's not going to be any accountability or truth and reconciliation. It's just going to be us like holding rigid around this building, and eventually other police precinct buildings as well.
When we asked Rondo, in the immediate aftermath of that, why that decision was made and by whom, he did say, I made that decision. Now, whether that was true or not is an interesting question, but the rationale that he shared was that there were weapons, there were guns
in those vehicles,
and that I think most of them were not actual MPD vehicles. I think those were the personal vehicles of those cops. And it was like this, I will never understand it as long as I live. It's like, why were there guns in those cars? Why were those cars there? We knew what was coming. It was telegraphed very, very openly by the protest movement that they were going to the third precinct. They were going to go from George Floyd Square on foot to the third precinct. Why were there guns in those cars? If that was going to become the red line to start, you know, to light that match on that bomb of people's feelings, why did you leave the red line there? One of the reasons I think that the fourth precinct didn't erupt the same way that the third precinct did is that there wasn't that same kind of like separate space that was away from the precinct building where they had some of their stuff. You know what I mean?
I mean, there was we're getting to tangents. There was a parking lot with some walls, and like there were some scuffles and some of the more hot action by police around that. But I agree with your fundamental point there. And it, to me, it speaks to this core question of like, again, like Jacob Fry doesn't have to produce on good, tangible leadership outcomes. His coalition does not hold him to a measure of, are you really doing a good job as a mayor, as an executive who directs people through departments to achieve the goals of those departments for the benefit of all people in Minneapolis. Like, that's just not the standard, because all of the, you know, from my own and our own personal experiences so many people have stories and experiences of that uprising, and I would never pretend to speak for any significant fraction of it. But from those like really powerful lived experiences of failure to the official after action report of what happened during the uprising from the city governance, right? Like, again, Jacob Fry 2017, the mayor is in charge of the police. And the quotes from the Action Report are like, it felt like nobody was in charge. It was a state of emergency. The mayor and police chief would have been in charge, but they were in opposition to the city council. It felt lawless. Minneapolis Emergency Operations Plan was well-written, comprehensive, and consistent with nationally recognized practices. However, as described in the following sections, during the events we assessed, the mayor did not ensure the appropriate implementation of that emergency operations plan. No formal briefings occurred involving city department heads early in the protests who should have been convened as described in the emergency operations plan. The mayor's office, or OEM, Office of Emergency Management, should have coordinated delivering one or more unified briefings to city agencies to ensure that all departments were working consistently toward the city's objectives. Instead, city agencies and city council members made their best efforts to make sense of what was going on and respond to their constituents. I mean, this is the official after action report with, you know, as much visibility as that group could muster into like what actually happened behind the scenes. You guys were also to some degree behind the scenes, right? But like, you know, what was your perspective on how the mayor's office operated through that couple of weeks?
My perception was that the mayor was absent and gone. I think I talked to him maybe once, and I was pleading with them to get the council together with the mayor. I wanted 14 of us to get together somewhere and actually do something publicly, even if it was just to say, we know what's happening and we care and we're trying to make it better, you know, and however we wanted to phrase that. He was unwilling to do that. I don't think he was even going to the wherever they were doing their command and control meetings. And I think there was a group that was meeting because I was told at one point that I could communicate with them and tell them about emergencies that were going on. And you know, if there was some big thing that I needed to get into that circle, I could, as a council member, I forget who I was calling. I wonder if it was an aide to the mayor's office. I should try to recall that, but I don't right now. But it seemed like he was nowhere to be found and nowhere to be seen, and he wasn't very involved. I remember when the fourth precinct and there was this street occupation, I was able to get a closed meeting about it, and they closed the meeting because they wanted to talk about security of city property.
A closed meeting of the city council.
Yes, of the city council, because that's what I thought we should have been doing immediately. Just like those department heads should have all been getting a briefing of what's going on, we should have gotten that next day, and we didn't. I don't know when we got together, but it was hard, and the mayor didn't seem to be involved. The police chief wasn't contacting council members either, and it was very hard to get involvement there. And I think they even cut Barrett Lane out of the whole process, who was supposedly the emergency operations manager who was in charge of implementing a plan. So they kind of left it to licensed law enforcement to come up with what to do. And also, it didn't seem like the licensed law enforcement leaders could control in the days that follow were controlling law enforcement officers at all. It seemed like they were just renegade going there and abusing everybody on the south side and probably the north side in certain parts of town. But yeah,
I mean, we have evidence of that in the Jaleel Stallings case, that they were riding around in vehicles that were not marked as police vehicles, trying to, like, I guess maybe in their minds get things back in order, but basically just like rough people up. And you know, he's the guy who didn't know who was shooting at him, and he shot back, thinking that they might have been the like white supremacists in vans that we were all worried about.
Right. There was real deep uncertainty about what was happening moment to moment.
Yeah.
And people felt that and experienced that in different ways around the city, but it was profound and I think pretty widespread.
Yeah.
And we could probably do whole shows about it.
Yeah.
But
yeah. I think there's a lot more to unpack
there. Really good at absolutely ignoring any real life emergencies that were going on the south side of my neighborhood and making sure we all knew that police and fire weren't going to come. Neither were ambulances. Yeah, good luck, everybody. But they were certainly shooting at people out on their porches. I mean, I heard stories about stuff that was happening in different parts of town.
The only time I've been around gunshots that might have actually hit me was being out on the street where my partner Angela lived at the time, just, you know, within the first block north of Lake Street, just a few blocks east of the precinct building, in that period of time when it's like, okay, we're all out here with our neighbors to make sure our houses don't get burned down. And, you know, like somebody decided to confront some people breaking into the TCF bank. And there were shots fired, right? And I'm like around that because I'm like, I don't know what else to do. Like, I'm going to try to be vigilant. I don't want fire burning down my partner's, you know, block. So, you know, it was really wild. It was in my, you know, pretty sheltered life, the first time I really ever experienced like, wow, I have no idea what the rules are. And to me, it's a sequence of events kicked off by horrible police intransigence. That's a not out of the blue, not a you know, some kind of black swan event, but a thing that's a part of a pattern that has happened a lot.
Predictable.
People warned City Hall about it explicitly. Like people from the Black Lives Matter movement around some of these other killings were saying, "Hey, this is going to pop off. The city's going to burn." Like people were saying that explicitly. Jacob Fry was the mayor, and then it happens again. And Jacob Fry, as the mayor, completely fails to provide any kind of protection to the real people, whether it's residents, business owners, protesters who lived in Minneapolis during this period of time,
and seemed incredibly incompetent at the time that it was happening. I mean, one of my signal experiences of all of that was the press conference that he had at something like midnight. I forget which of the days. It was maybe 2 days in. But Donald Trump, who was president then, had tweeted something awful about the situation and about Minneapolis, and I think maybe about Jacob personally. And Jacob held a press conference so that he could pretend not to have read those tweets, so that he could pretend to react to them in real time, as some sort of a strength and domination type of a thing. That is just my impression. I don't know anything about this, but it seemed really obvious that he went out there and had a press briefing where he shared a lot of previously known and not a lot of new information. And then one of the reporters said, "Have you seen the president's tweets?" And Jacob said, "No, I haven't seen them. Would you read them to me?" And so then the reporter read aloud the things that Donald Trump had said. And then Jacob had a very, very polished, very, very good, very like seemed like practiced response about how the president doesn't appreciate how strong we are in Minneapolis or some bullshit. After that little show, another reporter said, kind of in an exasperated tone, "Mayor, what's the plan here?" And the mayor said, "In regards to?"
"Mayor, what's the plan here? What are we doing?"
"With regard to?"
"Clearing the streets. A lot of businesses have been burned down. A lot of livelihoods have been hurt. We have not seen... We've seen very little police out there, just in general, at the third and throughout. And I'm just wondering, what is the plan and who is in charge?"
And you could almost feel the reporters going,
it's amazing.
"In regards to the city burning down, what are you talking about?"
Yeah. And that reminds me so much, like another just like part of this thread of mendacity around Mayor Jacob Fry is... from the Rondo thread, right? Rondo's going to save us. Now, Rondo didn't save us, and we have this tremendous crisis in the city, and it's COVID, and it's post-uprising, and the social fabric is just in tatters, right? And, like, I'm hearing gunshots, you know, off in the distance in my neighborhood on a regular basis. I'm sure a lot of people are, right? Like, it's just, we're in a different place.
People are driving like absolute maniacs all the time.
Yes. It is a different and a dangerous, more dangerous place, feels like more arbitrary danger. And again, obviously, like from my own personal perspective, and a lot of things go into that, but I think a lot of people had versions of that experience. And I remember being on a community call, a Zoom call, that I think the Powderhorn Neighborhood Association organized. And it was specifically a call. We're going to have a call with Police Chief Rondo to talk about this like uptick in violence and crime and people's fears for safety. And this was, you know, sometime after the heat of the initial uprising. And somebody was like, "Hey, Chief Rondo, you're talking about stuff, but like, what's the plan to stop the violence? Like you're talking about how we need to do it, but like, what are you going to do? What are we all going to do that's actually going to stop this uptick in violence?" And what he responded with was, "The plan is to stop the violence." And that was it. That was it. Just, I'm going to repeat back to you the goal and say that that's the plan. And like that's the tenor of like a consistent tenor of like what you get around public safety out of this mayor. It's no theory of how change is going to happen. No substance of like, oh, here's mechanistically how we're going to change public safety for to achieve better outcomes. And then no actual measurement of the outcomes that a lot of us care about, right? Like, so in the current campaign, he's trumpeting like, okay, we're hiring a lot more cops. Finally, we're hiring more than we're losing. And there's no accounting of, well, have we fired any bad cops? Like, we know there are a bunch of like especially egregious bad cops, Derek Chauvin being, you know, an obvious example. Well, who have we lost and who have we gained? And how do we know that anything is different about police behavior today? And he's trumpeting, you know, we've gotten through the backlog of, we're really making good progress getting through the backlog of police complaints. Well, in what disposition, right? Like, have these been closed in a way that there's accountable, like, discipline for some of these cases? Like, are we measuring that there are fewer abuses of police power, or like we're increasing the clearance rate on crimes? Like, how is that a useful metric of outcomes in terms of like, are we going to have another, you know, awful police killing? Are people going to routinely feel afraid of calling the police to, you know, when they want to get help? Right. Like, it's all just this kind of like surface level. I'm going to latch onto a small detail and just magnify that. There's just a tremendous like obscuring of any of the real processes that lead to outcomes around public safety.
Yeah. Just in the aftermath of the uprising, while the uprising was really still going on, we were desperately working with advocates, folks from Black Visions, folks from MPD 150, and a supermajority of the council to try to come up with something to make progress on this whole question, but also in the immediate sense to help folks feel like they didn't have to burn the city down in order to get the attention of their government. The Martin Luther King line on this that I was thinking about a lot during that whole time.
And I contend that the cry of Black power is at bottom a reaction to the reluctance of white power to make the kind of changes necessary to make justice a reality for the Negro. I think we've got to see that a riot is the language of the unheard. And what is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the economic plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years.
Part of what I think the council was attempting to demonstrate to folks in that gathering at Powderhorn was that people had been heard, and that people could stop burning things down because they had been heard. And I think that it actually did have that effect. I think that things had been quieting down. I think, you know, Jacob and Governor Walz have a theory of the case that it was all the National Guard that calmed things down. But I think the idea that, like, we, you know, yes, this was horrible, this was awful, what happened to George Floyd, and we are going to do something to ensure that it doesn't happen again, I think made a big difference. And when Jacob was offered the opportunity to sign on to that same kind of pledge to really change things in policing in Minneapolis, he famously said no and was booed off the stage to a chance of Jacob go home, and he left. But then he sort of jujitsued that into a sign of his strength.
This is another seeming turning point in sort of like galvanizing.
Yeah.
The Jacob Fry that we see today running for re-election.
And that was kind of the moment that the 2021 election really began, with Jacob running not really against any of his challengers, although, you know, the fact that Sheila Najjad was actually a member of the group of protesters and activists that who were actually trying to make this change was, I think, important. But really, he ran against the city council. He made the election about the city council. And that's when we first see his new party system of his PAC, his aligned pack, not just pushing him, but pushing challengers to a whole host of his opponents, Usur Arab, including in Ward 2. But, you know, that was the story in Ward 3, in Ward 11, in Ward 5, in Ward 4. The mayor used Powderhorn and used his own, you know, proud refusal to give in to the mob or whatever, as a rallying cry for a set of conservative challengers all over the city.
And he could have, and we could have, I believe the 14 of us could have gotten together and made some statement even before that. I think it was really wonderful and helpful that we were able to work with organizations and make some kind of statement too, though, because that was the community being involved and we really let them kind of drive and plan that. So I agree with everything you said, but I also just want to point out that missed opportunity, and what would have been more helpful sooner is if the mayor, and if he had been a good leader, would have said, we need to stand together arm in arm as everybody with our election certificates representing all those people and tell them that we care. And we hear you. You're not unheard. And he didn't do that. And I remember when the tornadoes hit North Minneapolis and RT was mayor. It was hours, and we were all together in a room. We were all talking, and we all made a public appearance together saying, we're here and we're going to, you know, rebuild North Minneapolis or whatever, however he phrased it. Same thing when the bridge collapsed. I mean, it wasn't rocket science, and it was obviously something that you should do if you're a leader, is get together and talk to each other and have a common voice and go out there. And I think it just, the fact that he didn't, prolonged the turmoil and the agony, and then he did play it out to his favor. And I think that even solidified his team approach so much so, even with elected officials. And no longer did he actually, I mean, city government works when you say, we're all in this together, we're on Team Minneapolis now, you have election certificates, I have to trust that, and we're going to, you know, figure it out. It doesn't work when you do what it seems like the mayor does and says, you're not really on Team Minneapolis, I decide who's on Team Minneapolis, and it's these six, not you guys. And that's really hurt the city, and it's continued to. And
he even had Team Minneapolis as his swag at this convention.
This year.
That's funny.
Yeah. It's this real duality, right? Because he has made such a point, especially in this last term and in this re-election campaign, of advertising how he's non-ideological and he's on Team Minneapolis. He puts the city first, not ideology first. He's the good governance guy. We can't have all these extremes. But he's, I mean, really, especially since that moment of the uprising, he's been the number one peddler of the idea that there are distinct divisions and his side is right and the other side are extremists, and we need to defeat and shun and like constrain that other side as much as possible. Like this new formation of, I'm going to create a pack and it's going to run candidates and they're going to be sort of tightly coordinated, is a real innovation, right? Like sold under its opposite, right? It's this kind of like core mislead move of like, or like double speak or whatever you want to call it, of like, we're going to sell, what we're selling is like real Minneapolis, and those other people are, you know, weirdo infiltrate, they're like provocateurs, right? Like we're just here, you know, what are we talking? Well, at the same time doing behind the scenes all of the mechanical work of putting together an ideologically motivated, coordinated and well-funded set of campaigns. It's really a tremendous like move that I think he's only allowed to sell, in my opinion, so successfully because of the way that like fear around the police and investment in the police is like such a huge blind spot for liberals broadly. Like, I think that is really like the magic sauce that he was able to pour over himself to sell this like completely contradictory rhetoric on top of a program of like, I'm going to be a systematic, you know, like
agent of reshaping the city in my own political, you know, vision, right? Like it's kind of wild that he gets away with that over and over and over again, and seems to largely continue to get away with it.
One of the interesting aspects of the aftermath was all of the work on the behavioral crisis teams, and I was not deeply involved in that, but I talked to the folks who were. Steve Fletcher's office did a lot of work on that. Dave Zaffron did a lot of work on that. And of course there were wonderful city staff who were working on it. The mayor really slow walked and fought back against that whole push to create a non-police response to certain 911 calls, which was one of the, I would say, you know, we in the aftermath of the uprising, Cam, you and I went out and had these block by block mm-hmm. conversations with folks, and there were massive divisions between people at those meetings. Some mostly older, mostly white, mostly homeowners were really scared by the violence and felt like the council has lost its mind, and you need to defend the police department more aggressively and really give voice to how they're necessary folks. And then other folks who tended to be more, you know, younger renters, people of color, although, you know, both groups had both perspectives, were saying we have got to radically transform and reshape the way that we provide public safety in this city. Like, this is not working. And in those very divided conversations that we had, one of the things that was not a divide, one of the things that was a point of basically like universal consensus was, let's create behavioral crisis teams. Like, and we had that story to tell about how, you know, back in the 1960s, the police were the ones who came to car accidents and transported people to hospitals, and they were not good at it. And people died in the back of police cars who could have been saved because the police were not trained to deal with people who had gotten really badly physically hurt. And folks in Philadelphia, people of color in Philadelphia, interestingly, created ambulances, and the cops really didn't like it. And they persisted, and it turns out that ambulances are a really good idea. Paramedics are a really good idea. Having somebody show up who knows how to treat someone properly who has been badly physically hurt and transport them to a hospital and stabilize them en route is a great idea, and it spread all over the country. Let's do a similar thing for folks who are not exhibiting violence but are having real problems, not physical problems, but mental, emotional health, substance abuse, overdose, all of the nonviolent things that currently a lot of police time is being spent on. And I don't think we heard anybody disagree with that idea. I mean, it, like when we had the thing at Carol Becker's backyard, she was like, yeah, that's probably a good idea. You know, it's like no one was saying that wasn't worth doing. And then when it got into the process, the sausage making inside City Hall and between the city and other jurisdictions, there were the folks who were really trying to make it happen. And then there was the mayor, and he really just wasn't trying to make it happen. And in some ways was really trying to stymie it and block it. And I see that as one of those interesting, like, missed opportunities. And it seems like it gets back to the team thing. It's like, this was team, not the police, and I'm on team the police.
Right.
And
it's very revealing.
It could have been a moment to say, to really go all in on that and really try to own it and make sure that it happened, make sure it happened really well, and have it be his thing.
He's going to claim it now.
He is going to claim it now. But everybody who knows what really happened knows that it's not true.
Well, and it was a real struggle getting it up and running. And also, I'll just note that it was started before Derek Chauvin. And I think we have to give Andrew Johnson a little credit, who really pushed hard to get kind of an audit of police calls to find out and how we categorize them, because it wasn't being...
working group.
Yep, done very well and all of that. And then moving it forward, it also makes me want to talk a little bit about the... I forget what they call that innovation and performance review team that grew, and Brian K. Smith, who led that effort. And I'm not sure how much the mayor was even involved in slowing it down or just let it get slowed down because of his staff. But it took a really long time to get where it is now, which is citywide, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. And interestingly enough, the company that got contracted to do it requested it get out of Community Safety Department, and it's now operated under the Fire Department, which seems to be a really good idea. And maybe we should do more of that. But I do want to talk a little...
That just puts the lie also to the whole idea of the Community Safety Department, that the Community Safety Department was going to be a different way of doing public safety in Minneapolis. It shows that it's just a rebrand. It's a fresh coat of paint on the police department. If the behavioral crisis response folks feel like that can't be a home for them, you know, there was this opportunity to create something that was actually transformative, actually new, that would have really led to a different approach. And because we had the mayor we had at that time, instead it was Fugazi. It wasn't a real thing.
And he was running. It was an opportunity he was running on 4 years ago. He was running on, we don't need this public safety amendment. We don't need to change the charter, at least in that way. We can do both and, right? Like both and was his big phrase. We can do both and police reform and still give the police a lot of money and still hire cops and have new forms of, you know, complementary public safety, right? So he's explicitly running on this thing and then he's fucking it up behind the scenes. He's completely like slow rolling it, stymieing it, making it harder to achieve. And it's like, once again, if you had integrity, if you were seriously about the things you said you would, like you say, Robin, there was no, it was such a sweet spot of like, here's a thing, a policy and a programming that we can run full steam ahead with and make a lot of people really happy, right? If you were seriously about, I want to improve public safety, but I don't believe in getting rid of more cops, and you think we need a lot of cops, if you were seriously about that both and approach, you would have absolutely embraced and ran with that. And instead, we heard rhetoric, nothing, nothing, nothing. And now 4 years later, he's trying to take credit for it.
Yeah. Sorry, Cam, yeah. I cut you off.
And I think this whole restructuring in the strong mayor system. So the last term, we haven't talked a whole bit about the last current term that he's on as mayor. But he created these new departments. And I think a lot of this was to look good. He's actually... costing a lot more for the mayor's office. This reorganization, for me, it was ridiculous. And of course, I didn't support the strong mayor charter amendment and can't wait till we can fix the charter so that it never happens and the police are controlled more democratically. But I also think that this Team Fry idea seeped into City Hall and staff. And I just want people to remember what it was like at the beginning of this term and remember when Heather Johnston was, what did they call this, going to be the new head of the public service office, or I can't remember now the name of it, but basically the city coordinator, and staff objections. And also, one of the reasons why the behavioral crisis response team didn't move forward is because I believe, and this is what I've got from talking to Brian K. Smith, who was charged with setting it up and figuring it all out and was having to work with 911. And he was getting blocked from getting any information. He was getting mistreated. It ended up that he and Ginny O'Beery sued the city for racial discrimination. And there was a large settlement because they were being mistreated. In fact, I think the racism in City Hall in those early days of this term was very public because a whole bunch of staff people came up and spoke about it. We also saw some of the greatest staff leaving. Brian Kay and Ginny ended up leaving. Sasha Cotton left, who was in charge of the violence prevention effort. Gretchen Musicant retired quickly. I think she was going to retire anyway, maybe, and she's not a person of color. But I think the list goes on. And they also kept trying to find somebody for the Division of Racial Equity. Now they call it, I think, Racial Equity and Belonging. I forget the name of the division because who was in charge of that? She also quit.
I don't remember.
Marsh.
Joy Marsh Stevens.
Joy Marsh Stevens, who was great at that and was struggling all that time under Heather, even when we were there, I think, was pushed around, moved offices, and was trying to build something and wasn't getting that respect. And it just, I think, it's clear that institutional racism doesn't just exist in the police department. It's throughout the city. And I believe that this mayor hasn't done anything to change it or push back on it. In fact, he's ignoring it. You remember the podcast when we talked about his state of the city. He made sure never to mention racism, a racial reckoning, truth and reconciliation. He avoided those things. He has something about opportunity. I mean, he tries to point to it a little bit, but he also hides from it. And he defended Heather Johnston. He didn't support the staff that came in and testified. Brian K. Smith actually ended up getting up and saying, you have to believe my staff and the other staff who are coming forward. And he got punished for it. And lots of people did. And they're now out of the city. And I remember getting very frustrated when I was there. I didn't know what was going on. And I was thinking, Brian, what is going on? You're supposed to come back with your recommendation. This is taking months. We should know what our behavioral crisis response team should be. And he ultimately did. He was able to come back with a model, an idea, a way to do it that's been very successful. And now he's gone. And a lot of great people are gone. And I think it's really challenging and difficult.
To be clear for folks who don't know, Brian K. Smith is a black man. Yes. Gina Obiri, black woman, right? Like these are people of a lot of people of color who were like pretty important city staff who spoke up during this this episode, which I think is really amazing. Like, and I also want to give credit to Heather Silsby and Southwest Alliance for Equity. Like, they did a whole presentation of this that helped at least for me to like open my eyes to that. Gina Obiri came to that presentation. Like, I heard some of this firsthand. It's really an incredible episode of when you talk again about what is good governance, what does it mean to be a leader and an executive of a city enterprise, and you know, like make outcomes for people. Like, it depends on staff. Like, you can't. And so these there's a lot of import to these battles, right? This did not strike me as like personal, like people are just, you know, peeved because I don't like so and so. Like, this was kind of an amazing outpouring of dissent.
Yeah. Can I just read a couple things Brian said to me? I asked him why he left, and he said, I was about to go anyway. I was tired. I had other options. And he had already taken a leave from work because of how toxic the place got. I knew I wasn't appreciated. I knew our work wasn't appreciated. It was just a bad environment for people who really want to serve residents. It was a super bad environment for black people. All the black folks who were in any position of leadership, those who went along with the status quo, as well as those who didn't, are gone, he said. Anybody who is trying to do anything to change the status quo and make the city live up to what it says and writes on paper but doesn't do, they're all gone. It won't get built up again until Jacob's gone. We need a different kind of mayor.
Yeah. One of the folks who left... Now, I don't think he was a city employee. He was a contractor and got to see firsthand how all of this went. It was Elliot Payne, who is now not just the council member for Ward 1, but the council president. So there is, I think, a response that's happening out there in the world. I think folks are realizing that this is happening. I don't know that it has built up to the level that it needs to everywhere in the city, but the fact that there are people who are willing to, at some pretty, you know, significant risk to their own careers, speak up publicly about these things is really, really powerful.
Yeah, 100%, right? Like, this is the difference. This is, we get back to this question of integrity, right? Like, the difference between a Jacob Fry and city employees who are like willing to take the L, right? Like, really putting themselves at personal risk to stand up for principles, like, is a really striking contrast. And there were so many. I mean, there were just like lots of city staff were willing to sign this open letter opposing the appointment of Heather Johnston to this position, right? And like speaking on it. And I can't think of another incident of that. Like, is there anything in your career in city governance where you've seen a similar scale of like outpouring of, hey, this city staff leader is creating a racist and unproductive and counterproductive work environment?
No.
It's unprecedented in recent memory. It's really wild. And to me, you know, like I even look at, right, like, so again, Gino Beery says, I've been managing work on unarmed public safety response for my entire time at the city. It's work I'm incredibly proud of and dedicated to. It is also equally draining because of the racism that the team and I must endure and fight against. I was made out to be a liar, incompetent at my job, had my ability to pass a background check questioned, embarrassed in front of community members and other staff during public meetings, forced to filter all communications with her being Heather Johnston through white staff, etc. All of that severely impacted my mental and emotional health and was ignored and covered up by city leadership. It's really, really amazing stuff.
Heather has dismissed concerns of black staff while addressing those of white staff, spoken to black staff inappropriately in meetings, consistently excluded black staff from meetings concerning our work. What examples have you, Mayor Fry, given, or you, Heather, about how you have addressed the issues here, how you've addressed the issues that we have raised in a 21-page document with evidence? We, the staff who stand before you and who have signed in support, are who council looks to make these anti-racist aspirations a reality. Listen to us.
And you mentioned council president Payne, who was also, like you said, pushing the BCR work before he was elected. And he says,
because we're talking about systemic issues and this isn't personal, but for me, it is deeply and profoundly personal. The reason I'm sitting up here today and not on the floor with the rest of my colleagues is because the day that I decided to run for city council is the day that I saw someone I admire cry as they were leaving the city on medical leave to take care of their emotional and mental health and physical health, because this place was so toxic. And we were trying desperately to change the way things are from the inside by working within the system to launch a mental health response, despite the arguments about defund or abolish. We were at work getting this amazingly successful team launched that everybody wants to celebrate now and wants to put on PR press releases and say, look at this, we didn't even need a question two. We didn't need a Department of Safety, Public Safety. We got this really successful mental health team despite that. Well, all the while, when I was working on launching that team alongside with my colleagues, we were getting undermined and sabotaged. And my only resolution to this, because this is a systemic problem in the coordinator's office, I was a contractor. I couldn't even report this to HR, the type of racism that I was personally experiencing. So my only resolution was to run for city council. What does it take to be heard?
And I'm going to try and include the clips because it's very emotional, like deeply felt testimony by a bunch of these people. Yeah. And it's utterly wild to me that this doesn't sink Jacob Fry as a mayor. And again, gets back to this point I'm going to keep hammering, which is that his coalition does not hold him to the standard of you have to actually be good at your job. It's not what the job to them apparently is not the job of what the rest of us think the mayor should do. Because how can you be an effective mayor and have dozens of city staff erupting publicly at great risk to their own careers and livelihoods that things are so bad at the city that we can't proceed down this path? Like, it is such damning evidence that he is bad as an executive and bad at leading people and bad at holding people to some kind of measurable outcomes that improve people's lives around the city.
And part of that is about the team, them being on his team. I mean, I think when you look at the folks that he has put into high profile positions, I think Margaret Anderson Kelleher is a great example of this. She is a powerful insider. She was the Democratic Party or the DFL Party's endorsed candidate for governor the first time that Dayton won. She has been in her life a very powerful person and an insider. And when he hired her, he hired her as the public works director, and she has no history running any kind of a public works department. It was a very interesting thing for me to watch from afar, because I was actually very, very close to the group of people that that encouraged Robin Hutchison to come to the city of Minneapolis from Salt Lake City, where she was running their transportation wing of their public works department. And Lisa Bender and Peter Wagenius and I all kind of had this little cabal to like get her to apply and then try to get her through the council. And I remember Barb Johnson making a big point out of, well, all you've worked on is transportation. You haven't worked on any of the other stuff that our public works department does, like, you know, solid waste and water services. Well, Margaret Anderson Kelleher hasn't worked on any of that stuff. The important thing was that she was like a powerful insider who was politically aligned with Jacob Frey. Lisa Goodman has been hired as something that sounds made up. I
think she's an event planner. She might have done that big truck parade. I'm not sure, but downtown booster.
Director of strategic initiatives, and she, you know, she's the quintessential Jacob Frey aligned power broker insider. She's literally bundling money for his campaign and threatening the DFL to withhold money for other campaigns and the coordinated campaign unless they rescind the endorsement to Omar Fateh. And you know, it, in her day job is working as this thing that he made up basically as a sinecure for her. The Abdi Warsami appointment, I did not think that passed the smell test. A Jacob Frey aligned city council member now gets a cushy job running MPHA, and we had to even like bend the rules to allow that appointment to take place before he had resigned his elected position. His former aide, Abdi Warsami's former aide, Abdi Salah, goes and works in the mayor's office and is now going to prison because he has been involved in Feeding Our Future. So there's this crony corruption Tammany Hall thing that's happening in City Hall, where what you need is not working well with your employees, it's not producing good results for the people of Minneapolis, it's not, you know, don't do illegal, corrupt things that are going to land you in prison. It's be politically aligned with me and be connected in some way to the existing sort of political and economic power structure of Minneapolis. That's how you can get a job.
It's not good governance. It's governance that's good for us.
I mean, it looks very
much... us being not all of us.
Yeah, it looks very much like the Trump administration. It looks very much like, you know, you get your politically aligned cronies who have no idea what they're doing. I mean, you know, it's like Pete Hegseth being in charge of the Department of... I guess we're calling it war now, which I actually kind of like. You know, let's just call it what it is. But anyway, he had about the same level of experience for that job as like a Margaret Anderson Kelleher had for public works.
I would argue less, but point taken.
Yeah, and I think Margaret did some work at the state. As she had a big cush job there too, under Walz, and then I forget what department she was heading, but I don't necessarily disagree with what you're saying. And it's curious about what are the voters really looking for and what do they really care about? And I think it was my dad who once said that people generally just vote for their self-interests. And he even kind of said, I think, that's what you should do probably if you want to have a democracy that really reflects you. So that worries me that the majority of people in Minneapolis, their self-interest is kind of to have a racist city government, is to do political favors for the wealthy and privileged and powerful. Yikes.
Yeah, is there a majority that's willing to be sold all of this rhetorical bullshit that is easily contradicted if you look beneath the covers at all, in order to what? Get a bunch of favors for property owners and landlords.
Be
and,
comfortable.
Yeah. And some, right, like some illusion of protection against the city council that's been weaponized. You know, like who is being sold this bill of goods is the question in this election.
But there is, I mean, I think that people recognize that it is not in their best interest to have the Minneapolis Police Department killing innocent folks. Even if
most people, at least, I do think there is a 30%, 20 to 30%, sure, who having door knocked. I think there is a hardcore reactionary that, you know, I had at my block, right? Like the cops, there's enough cops themselves that believe this, right? Like before the uprising, before the murder of George Floyd, I had cops at my national night out, and I was like, okay, Black Lives Matter is going on. Let me just talk to these random cops at my door, you know, on my block, and say, hey, what do you think of what the Police Federation president said about we need to be more violent and be more free with our violence? And they were like, yeah, that's a good idea. We should do that. And I was like, really? You're just willing to just say that to random residents openly? That's just how it's so normal and obvious to you that that's not even weird to just say, yeah, we believe we should be doing a lot more unrestrained violence. Like, I do think there is a significant fraction of people, even here in Minneapolis, who are just like, yeah, the police should do more unrestrained violence.
Point taken. But I do think that the majority of the folks who live in Minneapolis looked at what happened to George Floyd and said, that's horrible. That shouldn't happen in my town. And then they looked at the aftermath of that. They looked at the community response. They looked at the destruction on Lake Street and said, that's a pretty predictable outcome when something as horrific as this happens. And so even if I'm not personally motivated, even if I don't think that the police are probably going to kill me or my kids because of the color of my skin and where I live, it's bad for me if they're killing anybody in town, at least in part because it sets off this reaction that gets so completely out of control and so scary and so violent to me. And so even Jacob Frey, so when he's running in 2021, he's not running on the cops are great and they should be allowed to do more violence. He's running on both and. He's running on, we need serious reform, but this isn't serious reform. They're just trying to get rid of the police department, and we need to keep the police but make them better. There's always that second part. And one of the ways that he ran in that way was he told everyone in town that he had banned no-knock warrants. That was one of the big things that was on all of his literature. I banned no-knock warrants. And it was a bald-faced lie. And I called it out as a lie when he started telling it, because we actually looked at the police procedure manual, and we learned that what they had actually done was make it so that, so like everybody else, when you hear no-knock warrant, what you think is, oh, now the cops are going to have to knock on my door and wait for me to come to the door, and then they can execute the warrant. And a no-knock warrant is they break your door down, and they go inside your house.
Guns drawn,
to arrest you. And what he did was he changed it so that they can break your door down, but they have to announce that they are police right before they enter the house instead of right after they enter the house. So, and the difference, again, the difference between those two things is like microscopic, you know, it could be like the difference of half a second where they say police and where their foot is when they say police. And he used in that legalistic, mendacious way, he used that to say, I've banned that practice. And then they went out and filed in the next year some 90 requests for no-knock warrants, and one of those killed a guy, killed Amir Locke, who was a person who was not even the person they were looking for. He was sleeping on the couch. He didn't even live there. And after that event that showed that it had been a lie the entire time, Jacob then pledged to do, again, the thing he had already run on having done, to re-ban no-knock warrants. So I think there is this, I mean, I think there's a group of people in Minneapolis who are all too willing to be lied to in that way, but they do need to pitch the lie.
So I think that, I mean, that's kind of the story of the last, well, the last term, the last 4 years to me is being sort of galvanized / galvanizing himself as this avatar of essentially the hardest right quadrant of Minneapolis politics around, you know, with like the tent pole being police and police funding and police, you know, autonomy / you know, impunity, however you want to look at it. And that really like it sort of sets in stone this coalition around him, and he continues, and his camp continues to do this very active, like, we're not only going to just sit over here, but we're going to be very active and try to like unseat anybody who might threaten our sustainability as having power in this position. Well, simultaneously, like, and I don't know if these things are related or not, but simultaneously, like, deeply eroding personnel issues and a workplace, and a, like the means of actually achieving things in City Hall, like really fucking that up. And still, 4 years later, still seeming to run on kind of the same thing. Right? Now we got Trump 2 and we're kind of orienting it, using that as a new form of cover, right? Like our last cover was, you're all scared of what might happen to the police and who will we call an emergency, and the city council is trying to take that from you. And they're still kind of running on that as one of the big, you know, shadow things, right? Again, because he hasn't, what has he really delivered in terms of good outcomes for people in the last 4 years to point to otherwise? And also this new thing of like, well, you know, you see, you know, my opponents are extremists. Trump is an extremist. They're all extremists. I'm the only reasonable one. I'm the only not ideological one. Do you really want extremists running the place? Look how bad things are. It's again this very reactive way to sell yourself. And I don't know. I don't know if it's gonna work this time again or not.
Hope not.
I guess we'll see. Yeah, I'm worried that it could. I think he probably feels like he's the safest choice for the status quo, and maybe that's what he wants to say, painting the others as extremists. And I think it's not just the police that people are worried about either. So it's renters' rights, it's workers, it's a class and race issue. And he still seems to be pushing back against real changes. His latest veto was vetoing a right to know when a piece of commercial property goes up for sale. And obviously the ordinance was crafted very, very carefully, because it's not any commercial property, just some in certain corridors, certain areas, part of North Minneapolis. Latricia even voted for it, because I think I don't want to get too lost on this specific thing, but he went ahead and vetoed it because it's going to take away advantages for the insider developers who know when deals are happening and they can sell it to their friends or hold onto it and all of this. And I also worry that a lot of voters have grown tolerant of tragedies and horrible things. So I think there's this acceptance we make living in a civilized society or world that bad stuff's going to happen by accident because we're controlling for the good stuff. And there aren't riots after every police killing. A lot of the police killings that even look really unjustified or could have easily been prevented don't get riots. And it's almost like the average voter says, oh yeah, the police are going to do, you know, 12% of the time they're going to screw up an interaction. I don't know what the tolerance is, but just like we'll say freeways are worth it. Yes. You know, a certain percentage of people are going to die on freeway accidents every year, but it's worth the cost. And that's what I worry about, is those that are comfortable and doing well now, including us. Well, I think we're all doing pretty good, not as good as some, but we'll be okay with it. And maybe that's the deal that they're making. They'll tolerate the incompetence and the, what was your line about good governance again?
Governance for us.
Yeah.
It's good governance for us, yeah. But not good governance generally.
Good enough for me and my people. Right. So I don't know, but that's a concern. And I hope people won't. Obviously, there's other great choices out there who are running first, second, and third choices for mayor that people can choose from this time. It's a different race than it was last time. And I think we could see a big shift, and I'm hoping that we do.
I think there's also just, it's really hard for people to know what's going on inside City Hall. And it's really hard for people to know what's going on inside City Hall, partly because there is such enormous risk to someone's reputation and their career when they speak out about the things that they're seeing.
Especially under this mayor.
Yep. And, you know, we have a one newspaper town. We have one major newspaper in this town, and it decided a long, long time ago that Jacob Fry was the best possible choice for mayor. And I don't think that stayed on the editorial side.
No.
I think that absolutely has made it to the news side. You know, I had a conversation with a new City Hall beat reporter years ago, who asked me point blank, is Jacob Fry smart? And I, you know, I had to say, no, I don't think that he is. But the fact that that reporter understood what was happening, but that understanding doesn't get anywhere near print.
Right. You don't see news articles saying, oh, Jacob Fry, not well educated on the issues, or bumbling, can't execute. I mean, it just doesn't happen.
He cannot be allowed to look as incompetent as he actually is at the job. And so I think part of what's happening is the folks who are getting their news from television news and the Star Tribune kind of just don't know how bad stuff is. And it's not that bad for them. Their streets still work. The cops still come when they have an emergency. Things are going all right in Linden Hills and Kenwood. And I don't think that there is a broad understanding, unfortunately, that this person is a failure and very bad for the city.
Well, they should definitely pick up Southside Pride and leave that. And they just came up with their sample ballot. And under their mayoral choices, Fry's not there.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, right? It's like, if you are somebody who wants both and public safety, and you're a little more, and you're very skeptical of sort of communitarian economic changes, rank Jazz Hampton number one. If you're someone who wants, you know, racial justice in a sort of like fair-minded way where we're going to listen to all constituents and be careful and deliberative, rank Dwayne Davis number one. You know, like there is no, I just don't think even on the merits, right? Like, I'm ideologically much closer to what Omar Fateh is proposing as a policy platform. But any of the three of these would be a much more effective mayor at achieving the goals that most people and the outcomes that most people care about in this city, even just from the perspective of like working with the city council in a cooperative way, not pursuing a deeply divisive, like organized campaign of I'm going to push out you people with my candidates and reconfigure the whole city around me, right? Like that's where a lot of the polarization comes from and continues to come from, right? Like we can point back at like defund or not as a very polarizing moment in local politics, but there aren't that many actors pushing defund or anything like it right now. Like it just isn't happening. So where the engine of polarization continues to come from is largely Jacob Fry's camp, and you know, things like Minneapolis for the Many as a sort of counterpack have sprung up in reaction to that. But like That's in reaction to this very well-financed, like to the tune of, you know, $1 million in the mayor's race and more around the city, organized effort to reassign and reconfigure the city's politics around this Jacob Fry camp. And if you know what's going on, if you look at the evidence, there's very few people who should be ranking Jacob Fry number one. Like, I get just on the merits of like outcomes, process, abilities, talents, it just, the case isn't there, in my opinion. Like, and again, I'm fine if we have, like, we can deal with someone who's ideologically not where I am, but it's very hard to deal with a mayor who is operating the way that Jacob Fry is.
Hear, hear.
And Cam, maybe as one last thing I want to dig into in this episode is, in a previous episode, I think you said that Jacob Fry is mean. And you are one of the like kindest people I know in politics, and like most open and warm in your orientation. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about like it was shocking for me to hear you say that, just because like you're not somebody who badmouths people. You know, right? Like for you to get to that point, I just wonder like what brought you to that point to be able to say publicly Jacob Fry is just a mean person.
Usually you leave the bad mouthing people to your staff.
go ahead. So I don't remember exactly how I phrased that, but I heard it from some people since I left. Jacob seemed to be more interested in not dealing with me or talking to me, and I can't say that he was ever necessarily mean to me. But there are newly elected city council members. There are female city council members of color. And one of them, and I don't think she wanted to be on the record at all, so it's not necessarily fair doing this, and I'm not naming names, I guess, but I want to, was really clear that she was really surprised when she got elected and she didn't go along with something the mayor wanted the way he spoke to her over the phone, and she used the word mean. He's just mean. And I think that happens, and it's probably happened to other folks, I don't know, but not personal knowledge. I don't even think I've even seen him really angry or anything around me. Robin, do you? Yeah. I don't want to.
Jacob Fry has been mean to me.
Okay.
Yes. So we didn't talk about this, but it was an example of him caving to the right on when he was in his first term as a city council member. There was a plan to reconstruct, or maybe not reconstruct, but just really radically transform 3rd Avenue in downtown, the avenue that goes past City Hall, and add protected bike lanes through the whole length of downtown. And Lisa Goodman opposed that in her stretch of downtown because it would have made it a little bit harder for people to drive cars into some of the big parking ramps associated with some of the big downtown buildings along 3rd Ave. And it was a big fight. And Jacob was, again, kind of in the middle of that fight as the person, as one of few votes that weren't kind of known, one of the gettable votes. And he waited until Goodman had sewn up the votes for her position to prevail before voting with our side, with the right side, from my perspective. And I called him out on that publicly. And he called me on the phone. I remember pacing around my bedroom, having a long conversation with Jacob about whether it was fair or not for me to say these things. I think part of what he does is like a certain version of working the refs. It's like, I don't necessarily want to convince you right now to do what I want you to do. I don't necessarily want to convince you right now to like actually literally go take back the thing that you said about me on Facebook. But I want to make clear that if you're going to do that kind of thing, I'm going to call you and I'm going to harangue you and I'm going to make things uncomfortable and difficult. And we're going to have this unpleasant interaction, this altercation, so don't do it again. I think there's a lot of that. I think that has been a part of his MO for a very long time. And I've heard a lot of stories from other staff to council members, other council members themselves, who had those kinds of interactions. One of the, I don't even remember what this issue was about, but he called me to yell at me during a city council meeting. And I was at home for some reason that day. So you were meeting with the city council on a Friday morning, and Jacob had been requested to be there to answer questions about something. This might have been during the work from home stuff, so that's why I would have been at home while you were in a council meeting, and his staff said that he was, you know, he had something else going on, he had somewhere else to be, and the somewhere else that he had to be was on the phone yelling at me for a big chunk of that city council meeting, and I remember thinking when I saw, you know, that they had made that excuse for him, it's like, he's talking to somebody who's definitely not on his side, who can go out and say he didn't have somewhere to be. He was yelling at me the whole time. But even that, you know, it's like the constant ref working makes people feel like, is it worth it for me right now? Almost like a kind of a transactional thing. Like, is this thing a big enough deal to me that I want to risk getting yelled at by the mayor for another hour or not? Maybe I'll keep it to myself. And I think that's a lot of how things are going inside City Hall right now. And I think, you know, it's he kind of learned from the best, because this is kind of Lisa Goodman's approach. This is how she wielded so much power. It was like, I can be really nice to you or I can make your life really difficult. And it all just depends on whether you do what I want you to do or not.
She was also willing to do it more publicly.
Yes.
And I don't know that he is. It did remind me of one little interaction I had that was interesting that might reveal something about how he operates. It was an open streets right down here on Minnehaha. I was there and he came walking down with an entourage. It was a campaign year. I dashed out in the middle of the street to say hi to him because I thought it would be nice to say hi to the mayor who I work with. He kind of looked at me like, well, what are you doing talking to me? And I said something about how are you doing? And he said, well, why did you endorse everybody else? Why didn't you endorse me? Because I had been very public about my endorsements. And then I said, well, that's just the way I feel. And everybody knows that you're getting used right around against me. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, but that's not public.
Woof, man.
Yeah, it's better if it's behind,
closed
doors.
Yeah, behind the scenes, getting you, taking you down, and don't be open about it, I guess, or something like that. And it's like, okay.
It's part of what I look at some of his behavior in the last few years, and I feel like I'm reading a little bit of that phenomenon is like the people pushing back, it's like leaking contain, you know, like people like Jason Chavez are willing to say very openly these days, the mayor's making mistakes and making it harder. Right. And like, I see some of how Fry talks about people on the council, how he talks directly to people on the council, and just like how it's like really like there's a lot of I read a lot of like contempt in his body language and tone of voice and choice of words. It seems like that really, really bothers him that people are open about their criticism of him.
And he reframes that open contempt that he has for them, and how much he expresses it, as their lack of comedy. You know?
Right, like they are the uncivil ones to criticize my choices, so then, you know, it's like,
yep,
both barrels from me. But meanwhile, for years, he's been working behind the scenes to undermine what those folks have been doing and what other folks... It's like, for years, he's got a pack clearly aligned with him, and the literal staffers are people very close to him, calling them names and calling them extremists. But it's like only once, okay, this is built up and now they're openly criticizing me back. Now I'm really pissed. Well, I really hope we don't have four more years of that dynamic. We'll see what happens in a few weeks. Thank you both for being willing to walk through this not very fun story of the tale of Jacob Fry as mayor. Any last points anybody wants to get out there?
Yeah, I feel like this is a little bit of a downer that we're on here, but it just occurred to me while you were saying, I hope we don't have four more years of Jacob Frey. What an amazing thing it would be for the city of Minneapolis to make a change. And at this point in time, to elect the first ever man of color to be our mayor. And we have three choices that are probably, light years is maybe an exaggeration, but better than what we have now. And I think that it would be a real watershed. I mean, think of the revealing of the institutional racism in city government, in our development as a city, and where we are, in the police brutality, and all of these issues to make the shift. I think we can do it, and it would just be like sun bursting through the clouds and saying, now we can exhale, now we can breathe, now we can really start achieving what we can achieve.
Yeah. Amen to that, Cam. Well, as always, millcityhall.com. For more episode notes, I will link some of the testimony that we quoted from. I'll link Heather Silsby's article or in presentation, which has quite a bit more. Always check out Cam's Corner in Southside Pride. Any other plugs today?
I guess my only plug is if you've got a dog, if you've got a cat, if you've got any kind of pet in your life, non-human person that you are the guardian of, just give that person a little pet. Treat them well. We just lost our dog yesterday of 17 years, and I just wish I had more time with her and could pet her one more time. So be nice to your animals in your life.
Thank you, Robin. And we've got Princess Leia at my feet right now. I will give her extra pets for sure. All right. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. This has been Mill City Hall.